Welcome back to GI Pearls, the Gastroenterology and Hepatology Literature Review Podcast for the month of May 2018. I'm a little behind, as I mentioned before, in the process of moving, so bear with me. Hey, if you're listening, would it kill you to leave a review for the podcast on iTunes or whatever the platform you're listening on? It'll help others discover the podcast and help the audience grow. I've got my trip to DDW, which is happening in DC this year, all planned out. So if you want to meet up, I think I'm staying at the Marriott right next to the convention center. So hit me up and let's meet up. And now let's go to the journals. Another meta-analysis published in Lancet Gastro regarding PPIs and how effective they are for peptic ulcers. What do we get out of this one? Some more numbers. Odds ratio for PPI treatment for ulcers is 0.2. For an ulcer bleed is 0.21. How about for the ulcer healing, 5.22? Those are good odds. How about all these good odds effect on mortality? None. Other trials have shown no benefit for mortality, and this systematic review summarizes it with odds ratio of 0.009, but a very large confidence interval. Problem with all these randomized trials included was that the studies are small, with an average of about 80 patients in each trial. So there may be a small study effect or overestimation of benefit. But I guess we've got nothing better than PPIs, as H2 blockers and prostaglandin analogs probably work a little less well than PPIs. Yuri Hanada from Hopkins wanted to look at how often do IBD patients get non-C. diff infections. It's a great question. Let's say you have ulcerative colitis patient who was symptom-free for 5 years and then gets perfuse, watery, maybe even bloody diarrhea. Is this recurrence? Is this a bacterial infection? So obviously you send off a C. diff, I hope you send it off, and stool culture. Well, how often do these stool cultures come back positive? So they performed a retrospective study of IBD patients who had stool PCR or culture studies done when they had symptoms. They found about 1,300 patients like this with 50% UC and 50% Crohn's. 3 of the PCR tests were positive and 12 stool cultures were positive. That's out of over 400 samples. That was for ulcerative colitis. And in Crohn's, 1 out of 355 PCR tests was positive, and 9 out of almost 500 cultures were positive. Basically, 3% of patients had non-C. diff infections if you test them. Two things to take away from this. Yield of culture was higher than that of PCR, but the yield overall was very, very low. When patient comes in with a food bolus, it usually happens around 8 o'clock at night, sometime after dinner. So that way you're called to do endoscopy around midnight, and it takes about 4 hours for a patient to work their way through the emergency department. Now, there are different schools of thought about when you need to remove this food bolus, right away or in the morning. Various factors like ability to handle secretions sometimes plays a role. I had one anesthesiologist argue that if you do a food bolus endoscopy right away, like sometime a few hours after the patient had dinner and had a piece of food stuck in their esophagus, the likelihood of them having a stomach full of food is very high, since they just ate, and this increases risk for aspiration. I'm going to table the discussion for the moment, since we got this paper to talk about, and this one comes from Australia, published in GIE, and it looked at the effectiveness of a new device, basically a large cap that goes on top of the endoscope so that you can suction up the food bolus from the esophagus. In this paper, the group from Adelaide, Australia, described their experience disimpacting about 200 patients. Important to know that the door-to-endoscopy mean time was 14 hours. Half of those folks were done using the CAP device, and the other half was just using conventional graspers, all sorts of Roth nets, etc. And this wasn't a randomized trial, in case you're wondering. So it turns out if you use this CAP, you pretty much get the whole food bolus out in one piece. And you don't need to utilize any other graspers or nets. It's just a kind of one-and-done approach, which is amazing. And what this looks like is just a longer, a little bit thicker version of the CAP Assist thing you use to do colonoscopies. Just go take a look at the pictures. They even show a big giant food bolus being pulled out in the paper. Another interesting piece of data from this paper, which confirms many, many, many earlier observations. When it comes to food bolus Olympics, it's the steak that always gets the gold, with over 50% of the food impactions, closely followed by pork, lamb, and chicken getting fourth place and not making it to the podium. And that's the usual order of meats quoted for obstruction of the esophagus. Another month, another clinical guideline synopsis from Adam Sifu in JAMA. This one is on management of dyspepsia, review of the guidelines published in 2017 by ACG. And unlike the colonoscopy guidelines that I mentioned a few episodes back that earned a poor rating for management of conflicts of interest, this one got a fair rating. Overall, it rated good in many of the other categories, speaking of the quality of the guideline. As you may recall, if you've read the guideline, the new age to get the routine endoscopy for dyspepsia is older than 60. Keep in mind that this is because we are worried about alarm features. Remember those: weight loss, anemia, dysphagia, etc. Turns out that risk of malignancy without those is very low, but in addition, alarm features by themselves are not so alarming, since they do a very poor job of predicting who has malignancy, or in fact, any pathology for that matter. There's a small algorithm that comes with the guideline. I have simplified it even further. Maybe I put it on the website, or just email me if you want to see my version of it. Maybe that will finally persuade you to send me an email to my email address, info@gipearls.com. But if you don't want to email me, it basically goes like this. If a patient is over 60 and has dyspepsia, you scope. And if you find any pathology, you act on it. And if you don't, you consider functional dyspepsia workup. If the patient is under 60, you start with H. pylori testing. If negative, you go to functional dyspepsia workup, which includes things like prokinetics, TCAs, psychotherapy, etc. That's it. It's that simple. What do you do when all these things don't work? Well, it's a story for another day. The newest fad, and I'm actually a fan of this, is to check drug levels of anti-TNF drugs and act depending on the antibody levels. But does it matter whether you go by biochemical markers, say by ESR, CRP, or calprotectin, or just by symptoms alone? It makes no difference at all whether you use combination of biomarkers and symptoms or just symptoms alone. At least according to this trial from France. This was a double-blind trial of 122 patients who were randomly assigned to dose increases of their anti-TNF drug based on combination of symptoms and biomarkers versus symptoms alone. I mean, I think most people will look at the whole picture, meaning symptoms and biomarkers. And if biomarkers are normal, but the patient has symptoms, I think it's worth doing endoscopy and saving escalation for when you really need it. I think this study was way too messy and too small to figure out whether therapeutic drug monitoring is a good idea. And it's not that easy to do such trials because there are so many data points that you have to look at when you make such decisions. I think this jury is still out whether so-called proactive versus reactive monitoring strategy is best for Crohn's disease. And now that anti-TNF drug levels and anti-drug antibody levels measurements are very popular, even vedolizumab is in on the action. This next paper from Israel and China looked at association of vedolizumab levels and antibodies with response in IBD patients. This paper is unfortunately not very well written, so sometimes it's hard, at least for me, to understand what's going on. But from what I was able to gather, levels of vedolizumab was higher at week 6 of treatment for patients who are in clinical remission, 40 micrograms compared to 29 micrograms for those with active disease. I must say it's not a very big difference, but they did have less than 100 patients, so I'll give them that. Another interesting finding was that occupancy of the alpha-4 beta-7 integrins was near complete regardless of response status or drug level. Anti-vedo antibody levels were detected in about a fifth of patients during induction and only 3% during maintenance and did not correlate with clinical outcomes. So I'm not sure how useful antibody levels are at this point, at least for vedolizumab for now. Maybe bigger studies or more data is needed. I think that infliximab and adalimumab in this case are slightly ahead of the curve in terms of knowing what to do with drug levels or antibody levels. Now back to our regular scheduled guidelines. New pancreatic cyst guideline was published by ACG. Now I hate pancreatic cysts. Reasons being are the following. 1. There are a lot of cysts out there. One survey showed that 40% of folks over 70 have pancreatic cysts. 2. Everyone gets abdominal imaging and tons of cysts are incidentally found, and we are left to deal with them. 3. Some cysts become cancer, the worst kind of cancer, invasive ductal pancreatic adenocarcinoma. Even for stage 1, 5-year survival is a measly 14%, so it's a horrible disease. And 4. Almost no one with an incidentally discovered cyst gets cancer. 0.25% have malignancy at time of discovery, with a 0.24% per year conversion rate. That's 1 in 400 people. There's also some evidence maybe out there showing that most of the roadways we make in terms of treatment, whether it's surgery or anything else, is all lead time and length time bias, so we're not really making any difference. But enough about that. Let's talk about the guidelines. Table 1 has about 20 points of recommendations, and here's a short summary of some of them. One, most cysts are asymptomatic, and this one is there because if patient has symptoms, it's probably not the cyst. Two, MRI / MRCP is best. PANC protocol CT or EUS are second best for imaging.
Not sure if everyone's going to agree with this one, though.
Three, imaging tests are horrendous at determining benign versus malignant disease, so be careful. Four, if patient is not a surgical candidate, then leave him alone. Five, if you find a pseudocyst and patient doesn't have any symptoms, probably leave them alone and don't re-image them. Six, EUS FNA is for when you don't know what the fluid is or imaging is ambiguous. Seven, if you can get fluid, please send it off for cytology. Eight, use molecular markers. Many are very weak and still in development, but good examples are KRAS and GNAS, which can help you identify IPMNs or MCNs. 9. If your patient has an IPMN or MCN and don't want surgery, you can still do surveillance, but probably leave them alone if they don't want surgery ever. 10. Keep this one in mind. If the patient has new onset diabetes and cyst is growing fast, risk of malignancy is pretty high, and you probably want to do something pretty soon. Maybe get some fluid, maybe get an FNA, do something. And there are 10 more points in the summary, and I'm going to spare you the details, so go read the rest of them. They're slightly less important. And on the next page is the algorithm of what to do with cysts when you see them on imaging. And it's a very, very confusing algorithm, so it's very hard to navigate. I think the problem with it is that it combines both symptomatic and asymptomatic cysts. Symptomatic meaning like there's obstructive jaundice or maybe a solid mass associated with the cyst or something like that. And I think that's a mistake because that's why the algorithm is half a page. But that's all we have at this point. So one way to look at this long flowchart algorithm is just to ignore the symptomatic cysts because we know what to do with those. If there's jaundice, you probably know what to do. But the ones that we really care about, you know, the ones that we're breaking our heads about are the ones that are asymptomatic. So what kind of things matter here? Main duct diameter matters. Cyst size matters. Change in the main duct diameter matters too. And if there's any kind of upstream atrophy or anything like that. If there are multiple cysts, how big is the largest? Things like that. I think cysts are hard. I don't think there's a good way of summarizing all this stuff. Go ahead and review the guidelines. They're not bad. Speaking of guidelines, at some point I will talk about the new ACG guidelines for Crohn's disease that recently came out, but this is a related topic, and here's a question. You know those IBD serum markers, PANCA, ASCA, and OMPC? How often do these tests have a real impact on treatment or outcomes for your patients? For me, it's the way Rudy Giuliani recently puts it, zero. AGA often puts out high-value care articles, and this one is written by Millie Long and Bruce Sands, and they specifically talked about IBD panels. So what do Millie Long and Bruce Sands from Sinai recommend? Well, these tests are, number one, expensive, and more often than not covered by insurance. Some people out there use these IBD serologists to actually diagnose IBD, and you really shouldn't do that. And lastly, we have better tests like calprotectin, for example. Why not use those instead? And just a little preview, the new ACG guidelines for Crohn's disease don't even mention those. So stop using them. They're useless. Just one man's opinion. I don't know why I whispered that. Really, stop using them. And I'm sure somebody's going to write in and say, hey, wait, somebody can use this to predict who is going to get fistulizing disease. Sure. But don't use them to diagnose IBD. That's all I'm saying. What is the most interesting article in this month's Lancet Gastro? It's probably the case series of liver transplantation for locally advanced cholangiocarcinoma. In general, the only treatment for cholangiocarcinoma is complete resection, and 5-year survival for that is about 25%. Terrible. But if you have a hyalur mass, you can't really resect that, so the only option you're left with is liver transplantation. And in the past, patients weren't doing so well with this. So the idea of this article is a little different. Basically, they said, let's give some chemo upfront, see how the patient does, and then decide whether transplantation is a good idea or not. And that's because even with liver transplantation, some patients' tumors come back, and that's just abysmal because you just gave them a new liver. According to this case series from MD Anderson Cancer Center, patients with stable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma that received neoadjuvant therapy have an overall survival of 83% and 50% disease-free survival at 5 years. That's quite impressive, though only 6 patients included in this study. But still, this may mean that if you get chemotherapy for your cholangiocarcinoma and your tumor shrinks somewhat, meaning that you get some response, your odds of doing well after transplant are better. So obviously this is somewhat of a selection bias here, of course, but that's exactly the point. In this disease, you need to carefully select the patients who would benefit the most. After all, you're giving them a new liver. In addition, it looks like the patients in the case series pretty much got the worst livers available. So if these did well, imagine how well they'll do if they get, you know, your run-of-the-mill liver. So overall, very promising study. We'll see what kind of data comes out of other centers regarding this relatively rare disease. So I was about to end it here, but then a new article popped into my mailbox, and this one is from JAMA, Association of Colonoscopy Adenoma Findings with Long-Term Colorectal Cancer Incidence. So another paper touting the benefits of colonoscopy. This one is written by Benjamin Click from Pittsburgh, and this is a multi-center prospective cohort study of participants in the prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer study. So about 60,000 people had a flex SIG, and if it was positive, they were sent for colonoscopy, which brought the numbers down to about 15,000. And then they watched to see what happens to all these people years later. And on the first run, they found about 18% of people had advanced adenomas and 31% of people had non-advanced adenomas. And there were 217 cases of colon cancer found diagnosed with colonoscopy in the original cohort, and these were not included. 3 or 5 years later, they went back and did a flex SIG again and repeated this. And then they followed everyone longitudinally. And here are the results. After a median observation time of 13 years, participants with advanced adenomas were at an increased risk of colorectal cancer compared to those without any adenomas. So the relative risk of people with adenomas versus not for colorectal cancer was 2.6. But what happens if you had non-advanced adenomas, those itsy-bitsy things we find that turn out to be adenomas on pathology? Turns out that these people are at about the same risk as those who didn't have any polyps. And once again, proximal polyps were more associated with overall subsequent colon cancer risk compared to distal polyps. And here is where the European colon cancer guidelines are more firm than the US, meaning that if you have non-advanced adenomas, you come back in 10 years, unless your polyps are more than 1 centimeter. In the US, guidelines say that you have 1 or 2 adenomas and they're not advanced, you come back in 5 to 10 years, and I think most endoscopists in the US usually put 5 years plan if they find any adenomas. So there you have it. Less stuff to worry about if you find 1 to 2 small adenomas, meaning that people are at the same risk of cancer as if you found nothing. So keep your ADRs high and don't worry about the little stuff. That is all for episode 22 of GI Pearls, Gastroenterology and Hepatology Literature Review Podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever media you use. If you have any comments or suggestions, please send me an email at info@gipearls.com. The next episode is probably going to come out after DDW. And if you're coming there, hope to see you there. Thanks again.